Hi, and welcome to the Ryle Books Podcast. My name is Chloe, and for this episode of the podcast, we are publishing the launch of 45-120, a bilingual anthology of poetry edited by the Hoof Project and published by Caniche Editorial in 2025. The launch took place at our space in Brussels on the 26th of October 2025, where we were joined by the editors Bea Ortega Botas and Lito Ibarra. The publication 45-120 brings together the work of 18 contemporary poets to reflect on how the political, social, sexual, racial, class, and accessibility factors shape our notions of personal space. Personal space is understood as the distance between 45 and 120 centimeters that surrounds a person. Beyond a simple physical distance, personal space also becomes a stage where desire draws and negotiates the boundaries between the inside and the outside. The publication was edited by Hoof, a curatorial and research project around contemporary art and poetry directed by Bea Ortega Botas and Lito Ibarra, and is now based between New York and Madrid. Hoof has organized exhibitions, performances, and readings at Small Press Traffic in San Francisco, 99 Canal, Judson Memorial Church, both in New York, Gasworks in London, Sistema in Marseille, La Casa Encendida, Madrid, NYU Tisch School of the Arts in New York, Hangar Barcelona, and TBA 21 Art Contemporary in Madrid. We hope you enjoy this recording as much as we enjoyed the event itself. Thanks for tuning in.
Hi, hello everyone. Thank you so much for being here with us today, and thank you so much to Sven, to Ross, to Chloe, to everyone behind Ryle for helping us organize this evening. We are Leto and Bea, and together we run Hoof, which is an art and poetry project currently based between Madrid and New York. We are incredibly excited to finally present 45-120, which I didn't even get a copy of it. I've just seen it. This is the first place where we are presenting this anthology. It's a bilingual poetry anthology that we've been working on for more than 3 years, I think. So it's been a long journey, and I'm really, really happy. The project began with an invitation by the publisher Caniche from the north of Spain, and they just told us to gather writers that we liked, authors that we were reading at that moment. And truth is that that's how the project began, in a very organic way, domestic way, because Leto and I, we are partners as well. So we started like researching authors, reading them together, listening to their poetry, and that's how the collection came to be. And looking back, honestly, we can say that it's been like a dream commission. Like, it's been amazing to be able to work in that way and with so much time as well. But of course, this kind of working process also entails certain limitations. For instance, there's a temporal one, a geographic one, and a linguistic one, because we've only included poets that write in English and Spanish. And they're all translated for the first time, either from English to Spanish or to Spanish from English. And perhaps before I let you speak a bit more, Leto, it's worth making a small aside to explain a little bit more about Hoof. The project we run moves very freely, and I always underline this. We move very freely between poetry and contemporary art, and actually many of the poets included in the collection are also artists. Hoof has taken the form of a physical space in Madrid that we run it for more than a year, I think, where we organized exhibitions. You've been there, Castillo. Exhibitions, we've organized performances there, readings, but then we became spaceless, and now we're collaborating with different projects and institutions. And we also have our own collaborative artistic practice as a duo. But it's true that in everything that we do, poetry plays a fundamental role. Sometimes an entire project has emerged from a poem that we've read, or I would say that it's more that like our curatorial approach to Hoof isn't so much driven sometimes by a very strict curatorial conceptual frame, but it has more to do with a sensibility. And we find that sensibility through poetry. So that's the way we usually work and think.
And actually, there is an artist and linguist, Manuel Arturo Abreu, who explains this idea of transferability in relation to language. So this is something they take from Chomsky, and it's this idea of language as a tool that enables to transfer like a sensorial experience into meaning. So in this transfer, you gain something like the capacity to communicate, but you also lose something. these sensorial experiences inevitably reduce. And we like to think of poetry as allowing us to drag more of that initial sensorial experience and the emotion of the moment into language. So going back to the anthology, I'm just going to read the full list of participants, and it is as follows. Samuel Ace, Justin Chin, Kyle Dacuyan, Rhea Dillon, Tracy Fuad, Elijah Jackson, Taylor Johnson, Nadia Marcus, Park MacArthur, Nat Raja, Joan Retalac, Tris Sala, Juan de Salas, Maria Salgado, Asoto Saint, Cedar Saigo, Sam de Henry Smith, Nayare Soledad, and Perla Zúñiga. And well, the thing is that I'm afraid that none of these like 18 poets is today with us. So yeah, we were thinking like the best thing to do is to briefly tell you why this question of space became so relevant in the book, and then share some materials from the book and from our own personal archive of poetry and sound. The title 45-120 refers to personal space, which is defined as the distance between 45 and 120 centimeters that surrounds a person. And as we selected and gathered the poems, we tried to think of the multiple ways in which this like intimate and sort of unmeasurable measurement could be used as a starting point to challenge its apparent rigidity and explore how political, social, sexual, racial, class, and accessibility factors shape it. So beyond a simple physical distance, personal space also becomes a stage where desire and emotions draw and negotiate the boundaries between the inside and the outside, what touches and affects us, and what we keep at a distance. So also this title can be seen like a kind of an excuse to think about the way we move through a city, a landscape, a memory, a world.
So let me wait and orient myself. Yeah, so as Leto explained, we see a connection between poetry and emotion, right? This capacity to bring more emotion into language, into everything that we do. And actually at Hoof, we don't really believe that a curatorial or an editorial voice needs to be distant, cold, institutional, or emotionless. Quite on the contrary, when we curate or when we edit stuff, we think that that also has a mood. You come in. That also has a mood, that curating also has a temperament, that curating also has good and bad days. And definitely you caught us today in a very delicate and emotional moment, and we want to bring that particularity here this evening. So I'm gonna share something very intimate now, but since we are a small group, I think it makes sense. So a few days ago, a very, very dear friend passed away. His name was Pedro Herrero Ferran, and he was a brilliant artist, and his last works showed a very, very precise attention to space and to literature, also to code understood as a specific kind of language, and to how spaces become inhabited but also charged through emotion. So we've printed a few of his works for you to see. You can pass them around. You can see there like his hacked reproductions of the floor plans of international airplanes that he just stole from the internet. That he basically stole from the internet, and he varied in very subtle ways. And you can also see his works with the models of airplanes and airplane carcasses and the marks that they keep accumulating. So over the past days, as I said, we became very struck by his deep, I mean, we were familiar with his work, but in revisiting, we became struck by this deep interest that he had both in aeronautics and in airplanes, but also in cartography and in the marks that you can find on the ground. And as we were rereading the poems in preparation for the presentation of the anthology here, we couldn't help but see or notice that same tension between air and between ground running through many of the poems that were included in the anthology. So we saw this tendency towards flight, towards gaining distance, but also a disposition to, I don't know, to get closer, to feel the pull of the earth, right? And engage also with the violences that try to regulate and fixate land, for instance. So yeah, those two things kept, through the work of Pedro, we kept thinking of those two things in the poems too. And today, as a way of presenting this anthology here, we want to do an experiment of rereading the selection included in 45-120, inspired by the work and by the gracefulness of our friend Pedro. So starting from this idea of flight, the possibility of studying a place from above, and then inhabiting spaces in a completely different way, mapping with one's own body pressed to the ground and reacting to the very immediate, right? So both these ideas of, I don't know, the possibility of belonging to the matter of the earth, but also to a non-terrestrial space. So we'd like to welcome you to this, I think it's going to last 20 more minutes or something like that, to this experiment, to follow us here, to follow us in this undulation up and down with our friend Pedro, with the poets included in the anthology and with the archive that we're going to start sharing. Okay.
So we will start with flight, as Bea was introducing us, with flying, with the poem by Justin Chin that we have included in the anthology. Chin is a fundamental poet in Asian American queer literature, marked by both a rawness and a refinement that are like absolutely unmatched. And I'm going to read his poem, Soup. Soup means like this movement of going down. And in the poem, the narrator flies toward his lover. He squeezes distance by quickly descending from the air and trying to stop his lover from living with someone else. Soup by Justin Chin. These days, I wake in the scab light of damaged goods and benevolent memories. There is my fear of speaking, my fear of questions, my young, frightful past. Should I find myself in your familiar arms again? Your past scrape of skin, warmer than the blankets, and the cat curled at our feet. You explain how you need to leave one leg sticking out of the covers to keep your body temperature comfortable. And I realize how might my body get accustomed to sleeping one more night, knowing your heavy limb may never crash across my bed. In the same flash of late night television, insomnia, and a skew view of rhythms in which I discover the utter pleasure of falling upward into the glass of your breath and the warmth contained in your sleeping body. I wake to errant light, realizing that you are 350 miles to Los Angeles on your way to another lover. I cannot revise all that has transpired, even though I want to swoop in at the 100-mile point to tell you. My tongue memorizes the path to the soft spot, the hollow in your neck that nudges me back when you taste the tips of my fingers. At the 200-mile stone, I dive in to croon. I have cultivated the shadows of my body, of my life, into tough spots where you may sleep.
Okay, we'll continue with an excerpt of another poem in the book by our dear friend, who was also an artist, a DJ, and a poet, Perla Zúñiga. And the poem recalls how, after having surgery for, I think it was her second surgery for a tumor, she finds herself in a hospital room full of pain and sort of in the middle of dreamlike and pornographic visions. And towards the end of the poem, she finally wakes up and she realizes that she's in the intensive care unit. Yeah. Very sick and with a very bad diagnosis. And she ends her poem like sort of pleading for the nightmare, but also for the illness to end and wishing to fly to the moon and to get high there. So I'm going to read it. Perla Zúñiga, oh, 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 here we go again. The first time I woke up in the ICU, it was New Year's Eve, and three elves dressed like Santa tried to sneak into my room through a hole in the ceiling. A perfect circle drawn with a 1-meter compass, saw marks on plasterboard, the edge of a razor blade. It seems like I can still see their faces. At that moment, there was no other reality than that one. Santa's three helpers are trying to come into the hospital room on the last day of the year to wake up a sleeping beauty from her 5-day-long induced sleep. As they mocked me, they started running a train, as if they were butt-fucking each other, as if their cocks were attracting other cocks according to some unknown universal law, the way the heteros in my high school class used to. They noticed my presence and started humping the first desk that they saw and pretending to pleasure each other with violent penetration derived from the mediocre porn that we were all addicted to. In those assaults, there was an intrinsic desire to be seen by two future transvestites dressed in baby blue skinny jeans, those really tight ones from H&M that make your ass look like a capital W woman. Their masculinity allowed them to do and undo, because no one would doubt that those little bitches actually liked a dick in their ass. Masculinity is the best disguise and also the most difficult to perform. They stick their tongues out and laugh at me. They're still in that circle making obscene gestures like they're sucking dick now. So I press the alarm. The nurse comes and I tell her what's going on. There's silence again. She turns on the lights to show me there's nothing there. Nothing at all. Fairy dust. She goes away and I hear my mom crying in the hall. Then the weight and burden again, and I press the bell again, and the light turns on again, and the double-edged blade, and the truth, and the images, and the witch's fountain, and the little bitches, and me. I can't take any more, not any more. I want to disappear, to be sheltered by my ribs, smoke crack, go to the moon, see my grandpa, fuck Peter Pan, eat alive, and shit a tumor.
We are going to play you an audio piece by British playwright Neil Bartlett. The story he tells is set in 1974. Neil, a young man at the time, meets John in the bathrooms of Waterloo Station in London, and John invites him to come to his house the next day. Neil follows the direction to his home. This is a house that is located like very close to Heathrow Airport. And one of the things the young man remembers most vividly while being in bed with his lover is the deafening sound of the airplanes.
The first part of our lovemaking, I remember, happened in complete silence. But later on, I think after about 40 minutes, I can hear my 15-year-old self starting to make a lot of noise. I make sounds that I don't think I've ever made before, and they bewilder me. They arrive in the room without my even being sure that it's my throat that's making them, and I think I probably flounder a bit at this point and maybe even call out for help. When this happens, John doesn't stop. He's using his mouth on me now, and he's doing it better than anybody ever has before. Somewhere low down inside me, I am beginning to feel sensations that are too large to stay put. I can feel them getting impatient. They need to be acknowledged somehow. And as my back starts to arch, I realize these feelings or sounds of mine must be rather like those planes that John says are always lining up over his house, except these planes aren't high, they're deep. I start to pant, and then, I suppose, I start to sing. John still doesn't stop doing what he's doing, but with his spare hand, he does reach up and lightly brush two fingers across my opening mouth. Those fingers slip inside me, and he hooks them against my lower teeth, and I understand. John is reminding me that the bedroom window is still open, and that the water may still be turning into a spray of diamonds above the flowers just across the way. But he isn't telling me to stop. He is telling me to keep going quietly. He is telling me I can signal to those waiting planes any time I want to and bring them in to land.
Still thinking about airplanes, I'm now going to read an excerpt from a poem by Judy Grant, which is also not included in the anthology, but she's an author that we've been reading for many years too. And this one is part of her 1971 series, The Common Woman, and it's titled Carol in the Park Chewing on Straws. It's an excerpt as well. On weekends, she dreams of becoming a tree. A tree that dreams it is ground up and sent to the paper factory, where it lies helpless in sheets, until it dreams of becoming a paper airplane and rises on its own current, where it turns into a bird, a great coasting bird that dreams of becoming more free, even freer than that. A feather, finally, or a piece of fur with lightning in it. She has taken a woman lover, whatever can we say. She walks around all day quietly. but underneath it, she's electric. Angry energy inside a passive form. The common woman is as common as thunderstorm. Returning to the anthology now, Leta's going to be reading some excerpts as well, because it's a very long poem, a beautiful poem, by a Soto Saint, who was an Haitian-born American writer, a performer as well, a publisher, and an AIDS activist. And we're sort of going to use the poem by a Soto Saint as a transition from the airy to the ground, because actually the poem already contains this transition. It starts with a Soto going through the Evergreen Cemetery in Brooklyn and seeing how the wind sort of carries the leaves there, but slowly sort of getting towards the ground, climbing to the tomb of his lover. So the poet throughout the poem starts feeling that like this gravitational force on him, and sadly enough, he would actually very soon join his lover. It's Leto who's going to read some excerpts.
The Language of Dust by a Soto Saint. Where do you find strength to climb down the hill to your lover's grave? What do you bring past 13 years of memories? How do you deal with his death when your gasps loom in the autumn air like circling crows? Spasms rock your body like squirrels shake the scarlet oak and purple duckwood branches, while through the buzz of a helicopter, the roar of an elevate train, the firecracker thunder of a Buddhist service, one can still hear your sobs over and over utter his name. Jan, my Jan, even blindfolded, I will find my way to you around this evergreen cemetery. I will rest, not soon enough, right here, above you, in the shadow of the Trade Center towering in the distance. Manhattan, Queens, why should we be buried? Of all places in Brooklyn, you retorted. Drama queen. He reminded me of something I will do. Like that midday in summer, I freak, pull out my dick, jerk off quick on the geraniums over the grave. I also remember during my second hospitalization, we watched this television report on greedy companies that cremated corpses together and handed families the wrong remains. Open mouth shaken, you pace the room, we share in co-op care. Laid down with PCP, my throat go tight. Then last year, in the candlelight glow of a Swedish meatballs, Haitian rice and beans, anniversary dinner, capped with Entenmann's eclairs, you affirm to be buried with me will honor our relationship. That night, we curl into each other, aware one of us will leave roses, tears, and kisses on our tombstone the next November 9th.
You're now going to hear the track by, I think the title is Load Conduct. Yeah, Load Conduct by the musical collective Ultra Red from 1999. I don't know if you're familiar with Ultra Red. It's an audio activist, I think that's how they describe themselves, like an audio activist group that emerged during the AIDS crisis in LA. And the members of the group did this field recording in one of the parks that they frequented for cruising. And you'll see again that we are very close to the ground here, right? To the immediate mapping desire, or producing like a sort of a sonic cartography of desire, where you can hear footsteps, the bells, you know, getting unlocked, bodily noises, the sound of a construction site.
Mm.
Seymour-Lace is a poet and a sound artist as well, and he also has two poems in the anthology. And we came to know him through this wonderful collection that he published in 2019 that is titled Normal Sex and Home in 3 Days, 2 points, Don't Wash, which we think is such a perfect and Napoleonic and also hot and dirty title that immediately called our attention. And the book is absolutely fantastic. So we've translated two of the poems included in that collection. And I'm going to read one of the poems titled Lawns. I think this poem is a very beautiful way of understanding how spaces determine or shape our, the possibilities of life, of living and of loving in certain spaces. And it has this line that keeps coming back to us where he talks about green lawns and how they are both absolutely perfect. You can imagine, right? These very clean, perfectly cut green lawns in the US that are, as he says, like perfect, but also absolutely violent. And he has this line where he imagines those lawns like getting inside bodies. And it's a beautiful poem. I'm going to do my best reading it because I've been practicing, but I don't know. It's hard, this one, for me. Okay. Yeah, Samuel A's lawns. If you take those green lawns and place them into your body, you might have windows, cars, houses, stubble, flesh, sprinklers, and labia. If you place those green lawns and lovely finished sidewalks and the cracks we all jumped over right here into your belly, the earth might fall through the sewer system. And we would walk hand in hand down the streets to the traffic circle planted in elms, to the golf course, to a world where no one with a family of 2.5 kids in each house could have figured. On from the hard wall of lights outside the windows, who could have known all those green lawns made this a me and a you? To be better here, a river out our backs, your belly in my eyes, your legs between my own. And still today, could I take you there? Could I buy the house my parents bought in 1963 for $34,000? Could I move there with you, my lover, and our 3 cats and live wedded? And what if there were a child? What would the houses say? Would I care? And why would I be there anyway? Perhaps to go into business, run the same business that my father or grandfather ran, and live in the wide open, because everyone has the life I might have. I could uncover the treasure at the bottom of the tree I planted when I was 7. I could take your green legs and throw them in the dirt. The cats might like it. There are plenty of birds, but too many cars. Like Faulkner in Oxford, we'd live for a life at the side of the crimes, just to be reminded firsthand to say the grass. That grass, and the iron gates, and the stone steps, the culvert under the fourth green. To say the whistle that Peter's family whistled to call him in each evening for dinner. To say a neighborhood where any 7-year-old could wander far and play as a right and a given. Just to lie down and say, lover, I want to see you in the postage stamp backyard. To see you stand in the screened porch with the green furniture in the deep summer and the dogs on the other side of the fence and the tetherball set. I want to see you lie on the fertilized grass and flower beds where the backyards are visible all the way down to the Brandons. 5 houses away, the trees hang down over. I kiss you in public, chase you into the house, take pictures of you on the perfect green lawns of Ohio.
And now I'm going to read a poem by Taylor Johnson that is also included in the anthology. Consider the Deer talks about language as a strategy to come closer to what's around us, but also points to language's incapacity to really grasp or retain the material world. In language, a deer is the same as all deer, because like the singular and the plural are the same. And the woods are the forest, but are also the individual pieces of trees and trunks. Consider the Deer by Taylor Johnson. Consider the deer who, when I say deer, doesn't know whether or not I mean a single one. Though there were 2 dead and skinny with maggots on the side of the highway, or a group of them, always a bit lost in the divided woods. Blame our need to reach or leave each other faster. Consider the deer that I saw dead on the shoulder, midday, mid-autumn, whose neck in post-rigor mortis, pining broke itself again so that the head could face the woods. The woods setting itself alight. Oh, that I could turn and live again, the deer might say, recalling that one poet singing to himself, ruining the grass. Consider that the deer, when called, won't come alone purely due to linguistic vagary, who, like me, resists the gesture towards singularity. Call my name and the whole woods rise up inside me. It is a plural state of being. Consider the multitude before my footfall, how I'm able to crane my neck back, see only myself. We will continue now with an audio piece of Nat Raha, reading an excerpt from her poem Seals, included in the anthology and that was written after October 7, when the genocidal brutality perpetrated by the State of Israel in Palestine multiplied the effects of decades of barb politics. Raha's poems are full of syntactic and grammatical distortions, punctuation games, sharp inhalations, or deliberate stuttering. As you will see, the poem plays with the overlapping of voices and reverb effects, creating a collage made of cacophonies and superpositions that contrasts with Israel politics of regulation and separation, which contain and control space down to a capillary level, with checkpoints and militarized borders that restrict movement and turn the idea of territory into that of open-air prisons. Actually, this is a recording from an event we organized in Madrid a couple of years ago.
And the poem refuses to beg for forgiveness or rights, to appeal to moral sentiments. When tonight there is no ceasefire, tonight another hospital or block of apartments will be the target, labeled a terrorist base, that any number of lives is a sacrificial price for American and European-backed imperialism. And the poem's refrain is simply, no more genocide, no more military-industrial complex, no more dying. That any number another hospital or block of apartments will be the target, labeled a terrorist base. That any number another hospital or block of apartments will be the target, labeled a terrorist base. And in it were the shelter fashioned from tanks, rusted, stocked in the streets by the bodies of our friends or lovers or grandparents. And in these shelters we ate yogurt with honey, drank peppermint tea to soothe nerves frayed intergenerationally. And then, awake, lay lines for you, held by the fallacy of lyric, the hope of poetics. And here it was simply a cessation of work, a wildcat we laid down in an honest vulnerability, practicing the softest form of strength. Committed to deep empathy up all night writing letters, to friends forged and bonded amidst harm, the escalation of war, a permanent solidarity beyond ourselves. And if you can cross the apartment, and the poem's refrain is simply, no more genocide, no more military-industrial complex, no more dying. Stranded like a heart that never lifts, or a dust that becomes part of the fabric. And if I am binding the beams, wrapping the fabric, emerald clasped about our breasts, living by the shortest sentences of the most poetic manifestos, unbearable. Or cry out into cruel hell, cradling the howl of the dog. And the poem's refrain is simply, no more genocide, no more military-industrial complex, living by no more dying, is the most poetic manifestos. Cradling the howl of the dog.
Listen now to June Jordan reading poem number 2 on Bell's theorem or the new physicality of long-distance love.
Poem number 2 on Bell's theorem, or the new physicality of long distance love. That's the subtitle. This is the poem. There is no chance that we will fall apart. There is no chance. There are no parts.
We wanted to finish with this poem in which Jordan uses quantum physics to think about love. And obviously we are no experts in physics, but we like this idea of particles influencing each other over any distances. And well, because after 3 years thinking with the anthology about space, about what is far, what is immediate, and after a year marked by many painful deaths, We like to think that distances can be saved, that they can be shattered, and that basically the distance is the way that distance functions is not as straightforward as we initially thought. We like to think that we can be closer, or that we are closer to each other than what we thought, even though at certain moments we can't really see that. So even when there's fog, and that's a recurring idea in our practice recently, even when there's fog, even in the murk, we'll find our way. So just one last audio to close the evening.
This is a foghorn.
Yeah, just in case you didn't
hear that. I thought that it was obvious, like, yeah, not obvious for me.
It's a foghorn used by thank you very much. You have copies of the book in the front, and of course we'll stay around and we'll be here to chat about anything and discuss many of the authors that we haven't had the chance to read today. Yeah, go ahead. Oh yeah, of course. We could read one of the poems in... Yeah. We can. I mean, Leto is a poet. You can read something in Spanish. Wow. Yeah. I'm passing that over to Leto. Yeah.
To read from the anthology in Spanish.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We can read one in Spanish.
Okay.
Thank you.
Maybe with the book.
I really struggle reading poetry out loud. So it's new.
I'm not good at improvising, but which one can I read?
Just give us a few seconds.
Yeah. Maybe one that we have.
Sí,
o uno de Perla. Okay.
I think we're actually going to read, you know, we read excerpts of the poem of our friend Perla when she woke up in the hospital. We miss a lot of parts, so maybe we can read some of those parts in Spanish. Right?
Okay. Yeah, and we are sorry, like, this was like a kind of morning event.
Yeah, thank you for being with us on this.
Yeah.
In a particular event.
Yeah, sometimes like grief. Like, well, most of the times it's imposed. Like, in a year, we have lost like two of our best friends, and yeah, so they keep coming back.
La primera vez que desperté en la UCI era fin de año y tres duendes disfrazados de Papá Noel se intentaron colar en mi habitación haciendo un agujero en el techo. Circunferencia perfecta trazada por un compás de un metro. Marca de sierra sobre pladur, el filo de una cuchilla. Es como si pudiese volver a ver sus caras. En el momento no existía otra realidad más que esa. Tres pajes de Papá Noel intentando entrar en la habitación de un hospital, el último día del año, para despertar a la bella durmiente que llevaba cinco días inducida al sueño. Mientras me hacían burla, fueron formando un trenecito sexual, como si se estuvieran dando por culo, como si sus colas atrajesen otras colas por una ley universal desconocida, como también hacían los heteros que compartían aula conmigo en la ESO. Notaban mi presencia cerca y se empotraban contra el primer pupitre que veían y fingían darse placer mutuamente, gracias a una penetración violenta derivada de un porno mediocre al que estábamos enganchados. En ese atentado existía intrínseco el deseo de querer ser mirado por dos devenires travestis vestidas con pantalones pitillo celeste. Estos, bien estallidos de leche yeme que te hacen un culito de mujer en mayúsculas. Su masculinidad les permitía hacer y deshacer porque nadie en la sala iba a dudar de que a esos putitos les gustaba una buena manguera en el culo. La masculinidad es el mejor disfraz y el más difícil de performar. Me sacan la lengua y se ríen. Siguen haciendo gestos obscenos en la circunferencia, ahora como si se comieran una polla. Toco la alarma, viene la enfermera y le cuento lo que pasa. Vuelve a haber silencio. Enciende las luces para demostrarme que no hay nada, nada de nada, polvo de hada. Se va y escucha a mi madre, llorando en el pasillo. Entonces vuelve el peso y la carga, y vuelvo a tocar el timbre, y vuelve la luz, y la hoja de doble filo, y la verdad, y las imágenes, y la fuente de la bruja, y los putitos, y yo no puedo más, ya no más. Quiero desaparecer, resguardarme mis costillas, fumar roca, irme a la luna, ver a mi abuelo, follar con Peter Pan, comerme una vida y cagar un tumor.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Ryle Books podcast. This episode was edited by Roz Del Olmo. You can find more of our past and upcoming events on our website, www.ryle.space.